This is Espanglisher, a podcast of musings and chat from a lingua, logo, biblio, anglo, hispanophile. We'll be talking about words, language, and culture. So with no further ado, enjoy.
Niño! 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 Niño!
Hi there, and welcome back to Espanglisher. Now, what you just heard is a clip from an advert for the Spanish lottery. It's called the Lotería del Niño, which they have on the 6th of January, back from 2013, I think, or 2014. Anyway, we have the protagonist here today, Lee. Welcome, and thanks so much for doing this.
Hi, why? Nice to be here. Hola.
Hola. we can do it in English. That's okay.
No, just throwing one in, you know, just to say hello.
Cool. So Lee, we've known each other. I was trying to work it out, and I think it's probably getting on for 30 years. We worked.
Yeah, got to be getting close. Yeah.
Yeah, we worked together in the UK, and then kind of on the back of that, you came out to Spain. Well, we both did to work here. So my question is a little bit about when you first came out to Spain to work. Well, let's start with culture shock. How would you define kind of culture shock, would you say?
I think I was quite young at the time, and I think maybe it's the obvious things like meal times and lunch, breakfast, lunch and dinner, socializing and that sort of thing, really. Yeah, so a lunch break being a lot later than would be traditional in England and longer as well. So a couple of hours for lunch, which was really nice. But that was one of the big culture shocks shock that I was surprised by early on.
Yeah, I mean, the timetables, that's what, you know, a lot of people pick up on, isn't it? Had you ever, you'd never worked abroad before?
I hadn't, it was brand new. And like I say, being quite young, I don't remember it phasing me. I don't remember me thinking that it was going to be a problem. And having you as a colleague and a friend was also reassuring. And did we meet at the airport and fly out together as well?
I think we did. But I knew a little bit of Spanish, so I had that advantage.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I was nervous, but the culture, I think I remember just enjoying it and thinking, well, this is great. It's very relaxed. It's a nice way of life. All those obvious things that people who love Spain say, I suppose.
Well, what about you know, saying hello and goodbye, so you know, the kisses and, you know, different ways of greeting people? Did you find that awkward at all? I know when I first came out, I was like, oh god, stop kissing me every time you say hello.
Yeah, but I was in a bit of a bubble though. We went straight into rehearsing. So I was with you a bit and with Steve all day, you know, with you guys all day and in a bit of a bubble with that. So just, I think I must have been quite nervous. And one thing that I noticed was the promenading on a Sunday, particularly everyone out, you know, in dressed really nicely and out and about. I noticed that was completely different to UK, I would say.
And you kind of see the whole family, don't you? All of the generations out together.
Yeah, it's really nice. Another culture shock was smoking in the bank, in public buildings like that. trying to get all our businesses together and being invited into the banking hall and the bank manager smoking a cigarette. That was definitely a big surprise, because although it was acceptable indoors still then in the UK, you wouldn't expect it in the banking hall.
No, God, I've forgotten about that. You're absolutely right. I mean, now nowhere. which is probably just as well. But yeah. Sitting, being served, or being attended to with somebody just kind of smoking in your face. It's like, what? Yeah, it's a weird one. Okay, so you said obviously you were quite young when you came over, as was I. How did you kind of adapt? I'm thinking particularly with the language, you know, how did you go about learning the language? Because you didn't really have any Spanish, did you, when you first came?
No, none at all. And obviously, well, actually, I went to an evening class, but I think I could only attend three of them before I was due to fly out anyway. But so
it's good planning.
Three. Yeah, well, it was quite short notice, actually, wasn't it? So I sort of did what I could. I got enrolled on an evening class, did as many lessons as I could, but that was very basic, you know, entry level Spanish. And then when I got out there, it was difficult because, again, like I was in a rehearsal room in a play in English. So it's possibly a bit slower than it might have been. Although where I was staying, there weren't many people who were speaking English. I had to adapt and learn. One of the hardest ones was the hairdressers. Our landlord was a hairdresser or a barber in the complex where we lived. And that, obviously, the small talk when you're having your hair done is quite difficult anyway in your native tongue. So in the barbershop, I just found that very difficult, and it was very tense moments.
Yeah, wow, that's a really random thing to remember.
Yeah, but you know, you need your hair cut or else you're going to end up looking like a mop. So, I mean, he was lovely, and you know, he would talk away to me, and I tried to converse, but like I say, I had very little Spanish early on, so it was difficult.
Yeah, it's those day-to-day things, isn't it, that you don't even appreciate, you don't realise until you're in the situation, because obviously, as you say, you know, we were doing a play in English, and with shout out to Moving On Theatre Company, by the way, still going strong.
Whoop, whoop.
And yeah, we were doing stuff in English. Obviously, when we were on tour at the beginning, you know, I did most of the kind of official things when we were on tour, like hotels and talking to the teachers and things like that. And gradually, obviously, I think you picked up the language really quickly, just from like chatting to people. You know, because you're quite an outgoing, well, you're a very outgoing person, and you just go off and just chat to people randomly.
I don't remember it like that, but
no,
yeah, I remember trying to sort of take hold of looking after the technical side of what we did, and I'd go out and talk to the technical chap and try and do that on my own without you intervening. I suppose that's wanting to be independent, because you can't rely on the people around you all the time. So, and we didn't have Google Translate. It was just wow. You know,
it wasn't translating.
No, we didn't have that technology then. So a phrase book and a Spanish English dictionary and listening and learning. Actually, I probably would ask you quite a lot of questions. So there were informal lessons going on.
I remember you getting really confused one time about the song La Flaca. Do you remember that?
I remember.
Yeah, and you got really confused about the word fuera, because fuera means outside, and fuera is also the what we call the subjunctive of the verb to be. And you were like, aunque solo uno fuera. And you were like, if it was only one, outside? Like, no, if it was only one, but outside. No, it's a different fuera.
Yeah, I probably still haven't got my head around that one. No, music was actually, you know, trying to learn from music was a good one. I was introduced to a band called Molotov, who, I don't really recommend their stuff now because of what they say, but they rap in English and Spanish, a Mexican outfit. Mm. So I was learning stuff off there, and like you say, Alejandro Sanz and various people off the popular radio.
Mm. Oh, well, songs are a great way to to learn to develop your ear for a language, and to, it's much easier to remember, I guess, when you've got things in verse or things musical that you can sing along to. It becomes a nice, easy way to kind of get immersed in the language, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I've never been a big reader particularly either. And I thought it would be a good idea to get a children's book to learn some Spanish, as probably recommended. And we took a trip to the city and went into a big bookstore. And I found a book called El Pequeño Vampiro Lee. And because that part of the verb was is spelt L-E-E, it is my name. So I was intrigued by this, but the book was too advanced for me because it's probably aimed at 10 to 12 year olds or something like that. So I still have that book though somewhere.
Oh, good.
But it's still too advanced.
And yeah, obviously the El Pequeño Vampiro, it's le, as in
right,
to so, read.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember that. Yes, you like, oh look, it's a little vampire called Lee. So yeah, and of course we had a boss who talked about plastifying.
Which
plastifying, when we had to laminate posters.
Oh right.
He called it plastifying because in Spanish you say plastificar.
Right.
So we also had that kind of Spanglish thing going on. Oh gosh,
right,
that's
yeah.
One of the first things I remember.
No, but with language, there's the word madrugada. Is a word that I always remember because it doesn't have, there's no single word for that in English. It's the early hours of the morning. So I still always want to say madrugada when that is, and I do. And people go, what? And I tell them, yeah.
Yes. It's funny, isn't it? Sometimes there's only a foreign word that will do because we, as you say, we don't have necessarily a one word translation, and it just feels better saying it in Spanish.
100% is what you naturally, your brain wants to do is find the shortest route to explain something, and there it is, and it pops up and use it. That's what I say. Let's get it into English.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just pronounce it in an English way.
Madrugada.
Exactly. Perfect. So, do you have any memories of particular, like, anecdotes or things that kind of surprised you when you were on tour?
The sort of the sheer difference in different regions. In the Basque country, where it was one of the first places I visited for, really, outside of Madrid. And they were really strong people. They were just fuerte. They were, like, you know, totally different. And then later on, as we, you know, went across Spain, you noticed the difference between them and the people in the south of Spain, who seem a lot more free, a lot more relaxed. Definitely a real contrast to the north. Yeah, I'm finding that remarkable. I forgot to say about the culture shock with them, the difference in tea.
The difference in tea, like a cup of tea.
Yeah, because of the tea bags and the milk, so it tasted very different. So that's jumping back a bit, sorry.
That's okay. I'm not a tea drinker, so
I
haven't had that experience. No. Yeah, and as you say, the kind of the difference in the people. I mean, you get it in any country, don't you? From different areas of the country, you get different characteristics and things. I find the people of the Basque Country, when we were first up there, you know, as you say, like, quite strong, and they have this reputation maybe of being a little bit more closed, like less relaxed, as you say, than in Andalusia. But when you get to know them, they are the most loyal, honest people.
Oh,
I,
yeah.
I love it.
Very friendly too, once you get sort of in there a bit, you know, once you get to know. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. So what about, do you have any tips or about kind of culture, adapting to a culture or language, if for somebody who's going to work in a foreign country?
Well, I would just say, just embrace it and try and go with it. I mean, in hindsight, I felt like I maybe didn't open myself up enough and get on with it. Although you've said that, no, you did. You picked up the language quickly. Maybe I just remember it differently. But don't, it's a thing you get with age, I think, is to not be afraid of what's in front of you. But sometimes it's just there. And I'll just say, yeah, don't be afraid to get stuck in. Go and do it, you know, have an adventure, because it's good. Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, you know, we're both getting on a little bit. would you ever consider, is there somewhere that you would have liked to have worked abroad, or somewhere that you would consider working abroad again now?
Spain, definitely, because, you know, just the introduction to the culture. I still have a bit of language that I can use and stuff. So definitely Spain, but I'm happy in England. This is the thing. I'm happy in England.
Okay, Lee. Well, that's been great. It's funny that there's a lot of stuff that you don't remember, or you remember things that I don't, and vice versa. But I think it was an experience that, in general, as an experience, it something that you would never forget.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would do it again, actually. Yeah, definitely. I say I love England, but I would do it again.
Cool.
You're listening to the Espanglisher podcast.
So I thought, you being, you did just tell me, Deputy Technical Stage Manager? Is that the right title?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
At the Theatre Royal Plymouth, I thought we'd have a little chat about theatre, starting with kind of like your speciality, really. You know, we talk a lot about theatre and plays and actors and, you know, the benefits of theatre and the necessity of it. I've never really talked to anybody about specifically the technical side. So how do you see the importance of tech in theatre? You know, apart from the script and the actors and the audience, tech has a major role to play, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it all depends on the scale of what you're doing. I mean, you could argue that pure theatre doesn't require any tech, because it could just be a performance. And for me, kind of, I'm a bit at odds with what I do, because I kind of believe in that the purest type of theatre is just, you know, raw performance. But yeah, as you move up into commercial theatre, it's not just important, it's vital, it's crucial. You know, a play or a musical doesn't exist without the technical. It's a massive part of it. From the things, it's not all about flashing lights and video screens and sound. You know, there's just the minutiae to small bits of scenery and props, you know, so it is crucial, and it's integral to theatre, obviously.
Yeah, I remember when I was studying at uni, and they talked to us about this, and they said, you know, with the tech side, the lighting, for example, it's good if you don't notice it.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
And that's quite hard to achieve.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the big shows, you won't be able to not notice it, because they go for flashy lights and moving and massive. It seems that it's very popular to have big bass hits on things nowadays as well, for impact. So yeah, I don't know about not noticing it. Sometimes you can't get away from it now.
And a new technology is kind of influencing the tech side of theatre?
Yeah, absolutely. So LED technology has transformed lighting rigs. Use a lot less power. Also, LED video walls now, you can get these massive walls in. They're still consuming a lot of power because they're LED. They're a lot smaller. So the visual effects you can create on stage are amazing. And automation as well. So I come from the background of flying, which is bringing scenery and lighting in from the fly tower to stage level. Mm-hmm. As automation is getting more and more advanced, so it's removed the need for counterweight flying in a lot of cases, and it's just very versatile over the stage, moving objects around stage. Automation is kind of the way forward in theatre.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the first things I learned when we did our tech spec on my course, so the technical specialisation, I think the first thing I learned, and probably the only thing I remember, was heads
up. Yeah.
So basically, this, if anybody, any of you, one of my listeners, don't know what I'm referring to, when you kind of go up a ladder and you're rigging lights, you're taking them down or you're putting them up, and it, you know, there's going to be an accident, it slips out of your hand, you must shout, "Heads!" And everybody kind of ducks and runs away. It's a pretty important thing to learn at the beginning.
Yeah, we'll call that from the fly floor. Every time we fly a piece in, you shout "heads" or "heads up,"
yeah,
so that everyone knows that something major's coming in. Because it's amazing how people don't look up.
No. No, why would you?
Yeah.
And working at that lovely theatre in Plymouth.
Yeah.
How popular is theatre these days in the UK, you know? Because here in Spain, I mean, you've got big audiences for the big shows, you know, the big musicals and things. But, you know, theatre is notorious for kind of suffering, isn't it? It's one of the performance arts that, you know, theatre companies have to close and things because they don't have the audiences. I mean, I don't know. I haven't lived in the UK for so long. How popular is it? I mean, do you get good houses?
Yeah, we do. The Theatre Royal Plymouth is in a large catchment area, so the city, there's a good, I can't remember what the population is, but there's a good catchment area through into Cornwall and you know, possibly the rest of Devon as well. So we get good audiences. We put on some big shows. We're one of the biggest regional touring venues. But you know, as an art form, it's definitely popular. There is obviously struggle as well, but there's countless tours out. There's still countless product in the West End in London. So yeah, there's struggles for certain theatre companies, but it's on a, you know, a bit of a cycle depending on how funding is allocated. So you often get an announcement and a theatre company that you have liked over the years, is their funding has dried up, and then they sort of fade away a bit. They may make a comeback under different funding sources, but I would say it's still pretty popular. Yeah, pretty popular indeed.
And like alternative theatre as well, or is it just the big shows?
Well, that's where it's talking about commercialism, and that's where the money is. So at the Theatre Royal Plymouth, we have three venues in total. One, the Lyric, is the main stage, which is just over 1,000 people. The Drum is our second biggest space, which is just over 100 people. And then the Lab, which is a studio space for, I think it's about 40 people. And those are not making money. They still generate audiences. They're not always sold out. There is an interest in smaller and alternative theatre. But obviously it's all about making money. But Christmas time, especially for us, is amazing because we've got performances in all three of our spaces, from the smallest to the biggest. And it's just nice to know that we're producing something, putting something out for a wide range of people, from two-year-olds to however old in the pantomime.
Yeah, it must be panto season starting soon.
It's coming. It's a couple of weeks away before we start all that, but yeah, we've still got a bit to go before then. Yeah.
And you were in Edinburgh this summer. So the Edinburgh Festival, for those of you who don't know, is one of the biggest, or maybe the biggest, I guess, theatre festivals in the UK. And you were there this summer. I spoke to you and you said, oh, it was amazing this year. Can you tell us a little bit about that, in the sense of, you know, the audiences, the type of theatre that you were seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. I hadn't been to Edinburgh for 30 years, I think it was. I took a show there when I was at university, or the year I left university, I think it was. This year, it was first time in a long time, and I loved it. The weather was great, which helps a lot. And I saw a variety of things, but I didn't see a great deal. I didn't want to force myself into getting that really tight schedule. But I saw, literally from a performance with one woman and two members of the audience. The other member of the audience wasn't even a theatre goer. He was just in the pub and decided to watch. And it was one of the funniest things I'd ever seen, just because of the whole scenario. The show was strange. There was a lot of audience participation required, and there were only two people in the audience. So I saw, like, from that, which was a fringe free offering, so there's a bunch of stuff that you can see for free, So I also saw Figures in Extinction, which is probably one of the biggest you could see in Edinburgh. It was a part of the Edinburgh International Festival, and that was Complicité with Crystal Pite and Netherlands Dance Theatre, which is an amazing collaboration, a massive show. I recommend that to anyone. And a few things in between, and even we had a show, the Theatre Royal Plymouth had a show there called Down to Chance, which again was amazing. I didn't really like the venue, but the play was great. Saw a few things, and I just can't recommend it highly enough. I heard a lot of Spanish people while I was there. The streets are very busy, but obviously there is a theatre-going audience in Spain. Mm. Maybe I was just tuned into the accent, but, you know. Yeah, what a place. You know, it's really expensive to get hotel accommodation at that time of year in Edinburgh because the tattoo is going on, all sorts going on. But if you can do it, I recommend it. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, so you would say theatre's alive and kicking in the UK still?
It is, yeah, definitely. However, I do recognise that it is a little bit elitist. You know, theatre costs a lot of money. Big theatre costs a real lot of money to go and see. You know, if you're a family of four going to see, we've got Matthew Bourne at the moment, who's a very famous choreographer doing his show of Red Shoes. But, you know, tickets to go and see something like that of that scale, I'm not singling that out particularly, but, you know, it's cost a lot of money. So I'm aware that there are the poorer people in the city, in the country, are not seeing theatre because it's not really made for them. And that's, you know,
It should be for everybody, shouldn't it? Should be available to everybody, accessible to everybody.
Yeah, we do things like we allocate days where we are giving away tickets to schools. We're making an effort. Things are being done, but, you know, one day out of a 5-week run is not a lot. So, you know, maybe more needs to be done.
Yeah, just thinking, going back to the recommendations that you made of the shows that you saw up there in Edinburgh. Mm. I was reminded of a couple of plays that I've seen. One which I've seen, well, within the last few years, which has toured around England. It's been on the West End, I think, as well. And it's also been in Madrid in Spanish, which is the play that goes wrong.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Very funny play. Yeah.
Yeah, which is highly recommended. It kind of does what it says on the tin, doesn't it? It's the play that goes. They've got various Mischief Theatre. They've got various shows, and this one is like a kind of murder mystery, like an Agatha Christie type thing, and everything goes wrong all the way through the show. So technically speaking, it's a masterpiece, I would say.
You're right. It's amazing. I've not seen it myself, but I've heard a lot about it. I went to try and see it last time. I was in London, but it was sold out. Yeah.
Yeah, this is the thing. And then another one I saw, I can't remember, but I've seen various plays of theirs. This was something I saw when I was still at school, and it really blew me away when I was that age, when I was a teenager, which was Trestle Theatre Company, which are a theatre company. They do masks. They do mask work. The thing that struck me about them was that they were wearing masks, but it seemed like the expressions were changing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I know what you're saying.
Because
of
the way that they acted. And that, I mean, that is an incredible feat to pull off. And it just really struck me at that age. You know, how can I see a different expression on their face when it's a mask? It's not moving. And that's down to the quality of the actors and the
clowning.
Yeah, and some of them were really sad. Like there was a bittersweet one, like an older couple. You know, I don't know if the wife was dying or something, and it was, you know, really bittersweet. And you could see this emotion on the mask. It was just incredible. And do you know what suddenly popped into my brain while we were talking about those things? The Minac.
Oh yeah, the Minac. What an amazing place. Yeah.
Can you describe that a little bit, people who haven't heard of it?
Yeah, well, it's set on a cliffside in Cornwall, in southwest Cornwall, near a place called Porthcurnow, and it's literally carved into the hillside. It was the vision of a lady called Rowena Cade, and it's been going since the 1960s. It's an open-air theatre venue looking out to sea, and it stages some from community plays to professional theatre companies, music concerts. A lot goes on there, and is exposed to the elements. If you see, I've performed there a few times, and we performed The Tempest there. And
oh wow, perfect!
I think I might be getting confused in my brain now. This happens. Transpose one show onto another venue, it does happen. But anyway, when you've got the wild sea behind you and you perform at the Minac, it's just amazing. A bit annoying when the basking sharks swim past because everyone looks at them whilst you're still in the middle of a soliloquy or something. So it's like, okay, hello. All right, sharks, yeah.
A pod of dolphins just swims past and stops to watch for a while.
Yeah, yeah, that'd be fun.
You're listening to the Espanglisher podcast.
So yeah, we kind of made a quick reference to it before, theatre and education, so known as kind of TIE in the UK, doesn't exist in the same form over here in Spain. But when we met each other, we were doing TIE, weren't we? With a theatre company called Stopwatch, and what it is. Generally, it's a play done for kids, very often with a workshop afterwards. And the play is generally themed around some kind of social issue. It could be about bullying. What we did was about road safety, I think.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, that was chicken, wasn't it? Why did the chicken cross the road?
Yeah.
And it's a big thing. You know, we'd go into schools. Sometimes we would actually work in theatres as well. And do you have any of that in your theatre? Is that still a thing?
We have a department which I believe is called Education and Learning, which offers a lot of theatre related things to young people. As far as I'm aware, we don't have any product which is directly theatre and education producing. But yeah, I've talked to the CEO about that before. I think I mentioned it to him, saying, you know, this is something that we could do, something I've got experience in. Maybe one day I could, do something like that. But no, I think it's really important. It's one of the best forms of theatre for me. I've said before, theatre for escapism isn't really what I'm interested in, and theatre comes into its own when it's educating and informing people. I strongly believe that. And yeah, like you said, you can cover a lot of topics in a way that maybe a teacher or a counsellor wouldn't be able to do. I was artistic director of West Country Theatre Company for a while, and we created a theatre and education show called Love Bites, which tackled the problem of, sexual health in young people, teenage pregnancy, etc., and subjects relating to that. There was a big problem in the area I am from with teenage pregnancy at the time. And we created this play and workshop and series of questionnaires that informed the young people and tried to tackle the issue. And it was through the questionnaires, it was proven that we were making young people aware of these problems that maybe weren't aware before. So in a different way, a different form of education that, you know, we all learn differently. So there'd have been young people seeing this live action before them and being able to relate to the young actors who were performing in it directly, you know, and then interacting with them in the workshop and being able to speak frankly about a subject in a way that you can't necessarily in a classroom. So I think theatre and education is amazing.
Yeah, well, I think you've summed it up, you know, perfectly. And it's, you know, the educational side of theatre, it's so useful as a tool, isn't it? But also to introduce kids or teenagers to kind of the magic of theatre as well. You know, it's, oh no, theatre will be boring, or I want to be on my phone, or I want to watch a movie or a series, but kind of introducing them to the fact that it can be a whole other experience. Because, you know, when you're an audience, when you watch a film, you're the audience and it's passive, isn't it? Whereas when you watch theatre, even though
it's a shared experience.
Yeah, you're not kind of interacting with the actors necessarily, unless it's, you know, a participation type theatre. But you are it's an emotional thing. Yeah, it's the catharsis, isn't it? You have a group experience. The audience is much more necessary. I don't think theatre exists without an audience, does it?
There's a good question. I was touching on that in my dissertation. But to have that experience, that emotional experience, and you're surrounded by people who are having that same emotional experience and reacting to something live, then that is a unique experience. That, I mean, you know, maybe high level sport when you're in a stadium, you get it, but you know, theatre is quite unique with that.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. Yeah, the feeling of on the terraces of a football match, for example, that shared experience. Yeah, I think it's quite similar. Yeah, I mean, a film will exist as a film, even if nobody watches it. But I don't think a play does. I don't know if I'm getting too philosophical, but what would you say to that?
I've been going down a very strange route of thinking where actually I am the audience. We are potentially the audience. And I've created this piece centered around a tidal sequence. So I can go and see the tide perform over a 12-hour period, like in and out. And actually, I'm the audience and it's the world performing to me. That's an unusual conceptual thing that I've been exploring.
Right. Oh, interesting. Okay, so just to finish off, we're just talking about kind of audience and the theatre, etc. One final musing: how would you say Spanish audiences and English audiences or UK audiences are different if you've seen them in the sense of like teenagers or you know, theatre in education, educational shows?
Well, it would depend on the scale of the theatre. The experience I had in Spain of performing to people, it seemed to depend on the region somewhat. We talked about the Basque people, because we required audience participation in our show. The Basque people, the young people we performed to, seemed less interested in participating and maybe putting themselves out there to be up on stage in front of their friends. Whereas in Andalusia, for example, it was the case, it seemed, that most people would want to participate and be there and be up on stage in front of their friends. So that there was a difference there. So I can only speak from that point of view. I would say there's been a trend in the UK that theatre audiences have become, let's say, less focused, and there is more possibly more instances of audience becoming over exuberant and calling out when they're not supposed to, and security guards have been introduced into theatres a lot more because it's a hard one to understand, because maybe they've just been to a pantomime in their life previously where they're encouraged to shout out. They're now in a theatre show and they think they can shout out. And again, you see the Rocky Horror Show, you're encouraged to participate in that. And you go to a show called Sing Along the Sound of Music, where you're encouraged to sing along. So audiences have been confused a bit and sort of being distracted by our phones and having shorter attention spans. So audiences in the UK, possibly a fight broke out at pantomime.
Pantomime?
Between two women. So that's an observation I'd make on audiences. I could imagine a big show in Spain that people could get exuberant as well, though. So I don't know how that would compare, because our musicals a big deal in Spain.
Yeah.
I know it's not everywhere that they're popular, is it?
No, I mean, we've got, you know, we've had the Lion King, I think, is still on in Madrid. It's been on for years. Mamma Mia, those types of things.
Right.
Yeah, the kind of the modern ones, I guess.
Okay.
Okay. Well, that's been brilliantly, very enlightening. So thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. It's been great to talk to you. And
you're welcome.
We'll see if we can catch up another time soon.
Yeah, let's do it. Because I'll come and see you. I'll come and visit.
Brilliant. Can't wait. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Josiane. It's been fun. Bye.
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 Thanks so much for listening. Subscribe to the blog, espanglisher.com, for articles, short stories, links, and much more. Until next time, happy Espanglishing!